Yeah. Yeah, in fact, that's where we're going next. Let's go over to Ephesians chapter 2, verse 2. Ephesians chapter 2, verse 2. In which you once walked according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of the air, the spirit who now works in the sons of disobedience. Who is the prince of the power of the air? Satan. Satan is the prince of the power of the air. Now the prince there is this word. The Greek word archon. And it's Strong's 758. Notice it's very close in number to this. Notice that they have the same root. A-R-C-H-A-R-C-H-O-N. Remember that Satan is called by Jesus the ruler or the prince of this world. That's that same Greek word. John chapter 12, verse 31, 14, 30, 16, 11. And that's the same word as prince that we have here in Ephesians chapter 2, verse 2. I think what Paul is telling us is that there is a power over which Satan is the prince. He is the beginning or the first or the head. So what I'm suggesting here is that the principalities that Paul talks about in the heavenly or in the spiritual realm, one of those principalities would be Satan. He would be a principality. He is a head. He is a chief, if you will. Thoughts about that or questions? Oh, yeah, power is the same. It's the same word. Yep. Same word. Thank you for that clarification. Yeah, there's the Greeks, I think that to the Greeks that meant the air that was closest to the surface. It's not the outer atmosphere, but rather that which is closest to us. So the air that with which we interact, so to speak. Yeah. Interesting. Maybe. He certainly, as Paul is saying here, influences people. There's influence that he is asserting. Hopefully not us. Sure, sure. There is a gravity to that, isn't there? It's palpable. You can sense it. Sure. All right. Now let's consider Michael for a moment. Michael is twice called an archangel. Jude chapter 1, it's just Jude 9, and 1 Thessalonians 4:16. Although he's not identified as the archangel there, that word is used. The word archangel comes from the Greek I think I got that right. And notice, once again, that A-R-C-H, that root there, the same. What that literally means is chief prince, or the chief angel, the prince of the angels, so to speak. And in Daniel chapter 10, verse 13, Michael is called the chief prince. It seems to me that the principalities, at least in part, that Paul is referring to in passages like Colossians 1:16 and Ephesians chapter 3, verse 10, these principalities, I believe, include, but may not be limited to, Satan and Michael. I don't think it's a stretch to call them principalities. I think that there's at least some evidence and some circumstantial evidence as well. Remember Revelation chapter 12, verse 7. And war broke out in heaven. Michael and his angels fought with the dragon and his angels fought. Notice that Michael and the dragon being Satan, of course, they're the leaders. They're the beginning. They're the chiefs of their respective angelic hosts. They are the ones leading. So it seems we could say that Satan and Michael are principalities, at least two of the principalities to which Paul is referring. Any other questions or comments? Yeah. That's exactly right, Thomas, and that's good for us to keep in mind. Satan is powerful, but remember, he who is in us is greater than he who is in the world. If we have the Holy Spirit inside of us, which I believe we all do if we're Christians, we have a power available to us that is greater than he who is in the world. God and Satan are not equals. Michael and Satan would be of equal standing and power, but God is greater than Satan. And that's alluding to, I think, more of the angelic hierarchy that we're going to get into in a moment. Very good point, comment. Steve, go ahead. That's right. And the vine dresser is always greater than the vine, and the creator is always greater than the created. Absolutely. Very good. Anything else? Tom, go ahead. Yes, but I was going to use it in a different context. I got a direction I'm heading here with all this, although it may not be apparent that I am. We'll come back to him in just a moment. Yeah. Now let's talk about Satan's rebellion for a moment. In 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 6, we have the qualifications for the eldership listed. And Timothy is told not to appoint a novice to this position, lest, being puffed up with pride, he fall into the same condemnation as the devil. Here we get a very brief glimpse into the reason behind Satan's fall. What was that reason? Pride. He thought of himself above who he really was. Pride. He was lifted up with pride. Now, over in Jude chapter 1, verse 6... In Jude chapter 1, verse 6, or just Jude 6, my Bible program lists it as Jude 1, 6. So every time I cut and paste, it pastes in the 1 there, which is bothering me. I can't remember that there's only one chapter. In the New King James, that verse is rendered thusly: "And the angels who did not keep their proper domain, but left their own abode, he has reserved in everlasting chains under darkness for the judgment of the great day." Let me read you that verse in the ASV, the American Standard Version, in 1901. And angels that kept not their own principality, but left their proper habitation, he hath kept in everlasting bonds under darkness unto the judgment of that great day. It seems that Satan's rebellion was a rejection of the authority or position that God had ordained for him. That being lifted up with pride, he sought a station above that for which he was created and appointed. I think if we put 1 Timothy 3:6 and Jude 1:6 together, I think that's the conclusion we can draw. And I don't think it's unreasonable in any respect. That Satan was not satisfied with the authority that God had given him, and so he lifted himself above or beyond that principality, trying to place himself in a greater station or a greater position of power. And it's interesting, down just a few verses in Jude 9, the difference between him and Michael. "Yet Michael the archangel, in contending with the devil, when he disputed about the body of Moses, dared not bring against him a reviling accusation, but said, 'The Lord rebuke you.'" Michael did not, in this rebuke, step outside his station or above his authority, even when disputing Satan. He didn't say, "I rebuke you, Satan." He said, "The Lord rebuke you." So Michael has not sought a station or a position above that for which he was created. He is not guilty of the same condemnation as the devil. He has not been puffed up with pride. And I think in this, we can see what really separates the faithful angels from the unfaithful angels. The unfaithful angels sought a role or a responsibility or an authority that God did not create for them, while the faithful angels have remained obedient, have remained within the sphere of the authority that God created for them, and have not tried to act on their own. Yes, Tom, go ahead.
Which is another way to identify those who are with the Lord and not with the opposite. The ones that are ungodly are not afraid to be with them.
Yes. Very good. And that's a characteristic of false teachers. I wish we had time to get into Daniel chapter 10, verses 12 through 14, but we just don't have time. We're going to have to skip down to 1 Corinthians chapter 11 for just a moment, because I was asked to speak about that. In Colossians chapter 2, verse 10, we're told that Jesus has been made the head of all principality and power. And that's a very important point. We're also told that the Father is superior to the Son. And so if we think about the spiritual or angelic realm in these terms, we have essentially a hierarchy. If God is greater than Jesus, then Jesus is greater than the principalities and powers in the heavenly places. He is the head, if you will. God is the head of Jesus. Jesus is the head of the principalities and powers. That's really what I've hopefully illustrated in all this. Now, I think that becomes important when we look at 1 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 10. Now, this verse is found smack dab in the middle of what is a challenging passage for a lot of people. Verses 2 through 16 of 1 Corinthians 11 will elicit numerous viewpoints among brethren. Was the covering in this passage a veil or long hair? Were sisters praying and prophesying in public or in private? Does this refer to husbands and wives specifically or to men and women generally? Was this just praying and prophesying, or are these two a synecdoche, representing a Christian woman's comprehensive life? Was the covered head a matter of first century custom and therefore should be taken metaphorically, or should we interpret it literally and encourage our sisters to cover their heads? This passage is admittedly ambiguous, which makes its interpretation tricky and at times divisive. So I'm not going to talk about too much what these verses mean. No matter how we answer all those questions, the underlying message is incontrovertible, that God expects His people to maintain and openly display gender distinctions and roles. No one can disagree on that point. Verse number 3 forms the basis for Paul's instructions. But I want you to know that the head of every man is Christ, the head of woman is man, and the head of Christ is God. I think that fairly represents what verse number 3 is teaching. That the Father is the head of the Son is the head of man is the head of woman. Having established or reestablished God's hierarchy, the apostle addresses conduct which dishonors each gender's respective head. In verse 4, he says that if Corinthian men were to pray, if they prayed with a covered head, they would dishonor Christ. In verses 5 and 6, for a Corinthian woman to pray or prophesy with an uncovered head dishonors her head, the man. In both cases, the conduct manifests an unwillingness to or failure to honor the hierarchy ordained by God. This hierarchy was established by God from the moment of creation. Man's conduct should honor God since he is the image of God, while woman should honor man with her conduct. That's what he's talking about there in verses 7 through 9. God established this hierarchy at the moment of creation. This brings us to verse number 10. For this reason, the woman ought to have a symbol of authority on her head because of the angels. The symbol of authority represents a woman's open acknowledgement and expression of man's ordained authority over her. In the Corinthian woman's case, this meant covering her head with a veil while praying and prophesying. A godly sister openly acknowledges man's headship because of the angels. In other words, the angelic realm's hierarchy further emphasizes God's ordination of authority throughout the created realm. Angels are beings of great power and might, yet God has subjected them to authority with a hierarchy similar to our own. God, the Father, is the head of Jesus. Jesus is the head of all principality and powers. And principalities are the heads of powers, dominions, thrones, so on and so forth. I don't know how all that's organized, but I can see this organization in the angelic realm. That there is authority, that there is a hierarchy put in place by God. Thus, we should look to the angelic realm as an example. Realizing that God has organized all creation in this way, not simply men and women. By citing the angelic realm, Paul emphasizes the gravity of divinely ordained authority. Those angels who rebelled against the hierarchy God designed, who sought a station beyond what was ordained, were punished. They were delivered into chains of darkness and reserved for judgment. In condemning false teachers, Jude exposes that they reject authority. They speak evil of those who should command our respect. Though they are beings of great power and might, faithful angels do not boast beyond their role sphere, nor take upon themselves stations above divine ordination, as exemplified by Michael. Godly authority is serious business, and we should not treat it cavalierly. I believe that's the message of 1 Corinthians chapter 11. However that manifests itself in today's day and age, we should manifest it in such a way that we maintain the hierarchy God has put in place. He has ordained authority in both the visible and invisible realms. And I think that that's what Paul means when he says, because of the angels. All right. I'll open it up for comments and questions. What would you like to say? I think that that just describes the angel's appearance, that he appeared as a young man or looked like a young man. I don't know if... Mark 16 and 5. Let's turn over there. Why does he appear as a young man? Well, angels appear in all sorts of different ways to human eyes. I'm thinking back to that 10th chapter of Daniel. Daniel sees one angel, and he's got a gold waistband around his waist. His eyes are, I believe, flames of fire. He's got a different coloration. He looks very different. But then he sees a second angel that has the likeness of a man later on. We have a young man here. In Revelation, we have angels that are called strong angels or mighty angels, which by implication means there must have been angels that were of less strength or less might. I guess in answer to your question, what I would say is angels just appear different ways. I don't know if they are created to look different individually, that there's some sort of individual distinction to them. That seems likely to me, that they have their own individual personality, so to speak, or individual personal appearance. Have you found a good answer on that? Yeah, they do appear differently. Well, the cherubim, I mean, I would call the cherubim an angelic being, and yet they appear very different than other angels. So... yeah, there's the seraphim in Isaiah, and then they're called living creatures in Ezekiel, and they're also called living creatures in Revelation, but they all appear to be describing the same being. And I think you can make a connection that the seraphim are the same as the cherubim, because they're in the presence of God, and cherubim are always in the presence of God. So, I'm just throwing more dirt into the water, I'm afraid, but... this is where it gets very difficult for me to make delineations. It does seem that angels appear different. different there's just different types of angels, and they have different appearances. I don't understand why, but that's the consistent message of the Bible. And I don't know, they may present themselves differently based on who they're speaking to or the context that they're speaking. I mean, that angel, that first angel who appeared to Daniel in Daniel chapter 10, does he always look like that, or did he just appear that way for the purpose of explaining that vision? I just don't know an answer to that. Tom may. Well, I know that the angels who came to Abraham in Genesis 18:8, when Jesus arose from the dead, he was able to eat as well. So they have a corporeal body, but as far as what that is or how long it lasts or if it's only for the purposes of this realm, it's just really hard for me to say. But they're also called ministering spirits. That's why I find this perplexing at times, because we just don't have enough, I think, to put all these pieces together. Kenny, go ahead. Well, I think that's as good an explanation as has been put forward so far. And I think that goes in line with what Andrew was suggesting, that maybe their appearance is adapted to the circumstances that they're called to perform under. You know, maybe mighty angels appeared because they were doing something mighty in this vision. Maybe they just appeared that way to come as he saw those visions unfold. I just don't know. Yeah, he was under the age of 40. Yeah, he was a young man. Yeah, I had an interesting realization when I turned 34 this year. I have now lived longer on the earth than Jesus. That was a sobering conclusion. Think of all that he's done in his, all that he did in his life, and how little I've done in mine. So, humbling. I do want to get back to this 1 Corinthians 11 here, just because I was asked to lead a discussion on it. And I've got 6 minutes. This is my point of view, but it's not the only point of view that's out there about this phrase. There is a point of view that says that that angels observe the assembly of the saints, and that as observers, we should maintain propriety and worship for their sake. That's a possibility. My point of view on that is that still would go back to this point as well, that we need to maintain the roles that God has ordained for us, because if the angels are observing us, then we would be besmirching the name of God. To me, this whole passage is talking about authority and where authority lies. And as verses 11 and 12 point out, this is not a position to boast about. We need women just as much as women need us. We're here for mutual benefit. And just because God has ordained these roles does not make us as men greater. Remember, the sin of Satan was to lift himself above the station that God had created for him. And when men step outside the authority that God has ordained, when they try to step beyond that, they commit just as grievous a sin in God's eyes. It's a sin of pride. We need to be careful that we don't fall into the same condemnation that we don't. I think that's one of several weaknesses in that point of view. And I'm not saying that my point of view is not without its weaknesses, because it has its weaknesses. I will say this, that what I suggested as a second possible interpretation is founded on Ephesians chapter 3, verse 10. We might just take a moment to turn over there. In Ephesians 3 and 10, Paul says, to the intent that now the manifold wisdom of God might be made known by the church to the principalities and powers in the heavenly places. Now, to me, Paul's speaking about the church from a macro perspective. Beginning back at the beginning of the third chapter, he talks about the mystery. And the mystery, as I understand it, is that the Jew and Gentile would be brought into one body through Jesus Christ. That by one Spirit we have access to the Father. That the barrier that stood between the Jew and the Gentile back in chapter 2 was the old law, that Jesus has nailed this to the cross, that we're reunited into a single body. And Paul says in chapter 3 that he and his fellow apostles and prophets had been appointed to make this mystery known to the sons of men as it had not been previously known. Peter talks about that in 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 10 through 12. Of this salvation, the prophets have inquired and searched carefully, who prophesied of the grace that would come to you, searching what or what manner of time the Spirit of Christ was in them was indicating. So there was a curiosity factor. They were looking into these things. They didn't understand these things. And the prophets weren't the only ones who didn't understand it. He also says later there in verse 12, which things angels desire to look into. So there was curiosity on their part. To me, the instruction, if you will, that's taking place is not the church instructing the angelic realm. It's God instructing the angelic realm through the church. That the church is the medium by which God is instructing the angelic realm. And so it's not that individual congregations are tutors for the angelic realm, but rather that the church, the body, the unification of Jew and Gentile, the mystery that has been solved, if you will, that that is what's educating the angelic realm. That's more of a macro perspective, as opposed to individual assemblies on a micro perspective educating the angelic realm. I think that that's a sound interpretation. Tom, you have a comment?
I
will say that I was unable really to find any verses that supported the idea that the angels were observing the assembly of the saints. It's not that they're not observing. I just couldn't find any evidence. There's some verses in the book of Psalms that indicate perhaps that the angels were involved or observing the temple worship, but I couldn't really find anything about the church. And I'm not saying that they're not here, and I'm not saying that they're not observing. I just don't know. What I do know is that the mystery that Paul's talking about here has been revealed, that it's been made known, and it's been made known by the church to the principalities and powers in the heavenly places. So what God has brought in Christ has educated the spiritual realm. So as far as individual bodies, I just don't know. So Lewis, go ahead. Without a doubt, I think that they do observe the assembly of the saints. And I think that that is cause for them to rejoice. I know that they do because if a sinner repents in the assembly of the saints, they're aware of it. So there is an awareness, there is an observation taking place without controversy, at least to me. I just don't know. I just don't want to say that we're educating the angelic realm as some have suggested. As an interpretation for Ephesians 3:10. I don't think that's what Paul's asserting there. But yeah, I'm with you. I'm with you, Lewis. So we'll pick up again at 3:15. Thanks for your input.